Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. My guest is Marlon James. Most of you know him as the Booker Prize-winning author of A Brief History of Seven Killings, but I hadn't read that book. So when his new book, Black Leopard, Red Wolf, came out, it's the first book of a trilogy, the Dark Star trilogy. Yeah. Do I have that right? Mm-hmm. And it's published by Riverhead Books. I haven't been as excited, really thrilled, by a book in years, because this is a fantasy trilogy.
Yeah.
It takes place in the prehistory of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
But is it okay if I call it an art novel?
Sure.
Because I think it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a work of art. I think you took that Game of Thrones idea and brought it into stellar space. So much goes on in this book. The writing is so good and so inventive. And the reader is asked to do so much acrobatics. But the language is profane. This is the only fantasy trilogy that has in it every kind of sex that I can think of. Gay, straight, polysexual, asexual, with equipment, without, naked, clothed. Tell me what was going on when you wrote this book.
Oh, my God. Everything was going on when I was writing this book. Well, the first thing that was going on was that I was just sort of subsumed with research. I initially started researching this book, not necessarily to write a story. I just wanted to be lost in all these ancient stories. And it's not a problem, but one of the things when you come across European stories, European folklore, particularly the ones that were messed with in the past few hundred years, is that they're also Christian. It's like, it's almost impossible now to track down like the pagan Snow White.
Yes.
And the pagan stories are definitely different. They were a rollicking good time before we brought a lot of this sort of Calvinism to it. And I always say, you know, we may not be Christians, but we're all practicing Calvinists. And I think that enters a lot of those stories. Whereas the stories I was reading, the African stories, were so amoral. They were so sexual. They're so fluid. They villains don't always get their comeuppance. Heroes aren't really heroes. The person who's telling the story is actually lying to you.
When I started reading African stories, I read the guy that Ezra Pound was recommending, a guy named Frobenius.
Mm-hmm.
He did volume after volume of African stories, and they are marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
Who were you reading? What translations were you looking at?
A lot of translations right now actually are being translated by scientists, by archaeologists, and so on. So they haven't been... The problem with a lot of the ancient African epics, why they don't read like Homer, is that they haven't been translated by a poet yet. So a lot of it is pretty kind of serviceable, and me trying to make it out also based on African languages I know a little bit about. So I was just gathering anything, any new research that was just found and put on the net. A lot of it in French, which is funny because I actually don't speak French. So that was one more level of translation that I had to do. You know, I was reading compiled stuff for which people didn't bother to list an author. Like all the African myths of origin as a source anonymous. I'm like, no, there was a source. He just didn't bother to get a name. But the thing is, the further back I went with African stories is the more they had in common with Asian and European stories. So I was also rereading Beowulf, the Mamignonian, you know, all the Icelandic sagas.
What about the Arabian stuff? Like
Arabian Nights.
Yeah.
But loads of Greek stuff as well. The Oresteia, which I read the whole thing before I wrote this. I have a way of reading Greek drama before I write any book. because I was always that idea of a chorus.
We know that there is a narrator. We think we know who he is, but we don't know who his interrogator is.
No.
And it's very interesting because one of the things you're reading for in subsequent volumes is to find out who wanted to know this story.
Yeah. What's at stake for the person who's hearing it?
Yeah.
We don't know. At least not in this one, we don't know. But then the person telling the story doesn't know either.
Yes.
And I wanted some of it. I mean, it's a trilogy, so I wanted some of it open-ended. I'm not going to answer every question.
It's not just a trilogy. I think, Marlon, I think it's a circus. I think it's a celebration.
Thank you.
For years, people have been saying that writing in America has become sexless. Well, you redress this problem.
Yeah.
And how?
I'm not going to knock a lot of writers, but almost everybody who has won the Bad Sex in Fiction Award has deserved it. it's pretty awful. And also kind of classist, I think. It's I've said this, I want violence should be violence and sex should be sexy. That we have this kind of what I call indie film sex, where the characters are just coldly compulsive. The sex is very sexless. The cigarette is more interesting. And then all you're hearing is creaking sounds and sounds like fap, 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 fap. And then it's over and they go back to a season of self-loathing.
Some of the stories that you read believed in gods and others didn't. So you thought, wouldn't it be interesting to have characters who believe in gods confront characters who don't?
Mm-hmm.
And the worlds that these characters inhabit as they speak to one another is revealed by their confrontation.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the anguish of their confrontation can only be relieved by sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, they enjoy it.
Yes.
The other thing I'm a big believer in is that things like that should be explicit. Whether it's sex or violence, that it should be explicit. I have very little patience for space break sex.
Yes. Well, I have very little patience with space break fiction in general. This came into the world, the constant writing world, really with Donald Barthelme, who, when he finished a section, he needed a space because he was beginning again.
Mm-hmm.
But the continuity of storytelling is nonstop here in this book. Imagine my surprise when, after around 15 pages, I discover that there are hyenas who are turning into women again and again, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the women are holding dildos and they're raping our hero violently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have never encountered this in a fantasy novel before.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautifully done. It's amazingly done because the hero doesn't know who these hyenas are either.
Yeah.
It's saying that the world is endless mystery and wonder, and it's constantly being a source of revelation, sometimes painful.
Yeah, it's endlessly beautiful and endlessly brutal. And and one of the things that the characters in the novel know is that they don't get to separate the two. The uncertainty. I remember way back saying calling it African Game of Thrones almost as a joke. But the one thing I liked about those novels is the uncertainty in them. If it's one thing that annoys me about historical novels and historical epics is when everybody makes it to the end. I was like, most families, most children didn't make it to the end, even up to the early 60s. So the uncertainty is something that I definitely wanted in it.
Yes, I love that quality. While I think any number of people could buy this book and just plain love it, I loved it as a work of art. And, you know, it's a kind of special kind of love. Mm-hmm. I love it as a groundbreaker. I think that you cross all kinds of barriers, sexual barriers, race barriers, gender barriers, while it takes place in prehistoric times. What does that mean? I'm not sure. But it is modern, more modern than any book I've read recently. The question was, how do you write a book whose narrator is constantly shifting, where the characters are turning to animals and back again? And any relationship, any friendship needs to be sexualized and is.
For me as a writer, at some point I had to get out of the way. And almost, to me, it's to me, a novelist almost becomes like a journalist for imagined people. So I almost became a reporter, I pretty much became a reporter. And I think that that's why I could, you know, scenes of tenderness and scenes of brutality get the same amount of attention. And yeah, and I had to step out of the way. The funny thing about the modern elements in the book is that they're actually the retro elements in the book. And that's what I got from doing the research. In Africa, we there's a lot of news and a lot of news about how virulent homophobia is in Africa, present day African countries. What a lot of people may not know is how recent that is, that the homophobia is an invention. There's a character in it, I think Tracker talks about shogunmen. And shogunmen in ancient African history and lore were warriors, but they were the only, they were the only men trusted with protecting brides-to-be, the only protected the virgins because everybody knew they were gay and nothing was ever going to happen. So a lot of those things that sound new, you know, are actually old.
These are sentences that keep opening up to contain more phrases, more clauses. As the eye wanders across the scene, the sentence goes wherever the eye goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like Arabian Nights.
Like the Arabian Nights,
I like Bartholomew.
I do too. He was one of my teachers.
Yeah.
I'm talking to Marlon James about his wonderful first volume, Black Leopard, Red Wolf. It's just come out. I find it thrilling and exciting. I just get annoyed. There are people who are offended by the book. Am I allowed to call them wrong?
Of course you can call them wrong.
they're wrong. They want to go and be safe in the polite modes that have dominated the American novel, at least, for the last 40 years.
Yeah. And I never, it's always struck me as kind of insane that you'd run to a novel for safety.
Yes.
Why would you? You run to a novel for danger.
Yes, like dreams.
Yeah, you run to a novel. I mean, you know you're experiencing these things vicariously anyway. You run to a novel to have your rug pulled out from underneath you. You run straight for danger. You run straight for the forbidden idea. You know, there was a time when anti-slavery was the forbidden idea, or a gay relationship was a forbidden idea.
And there are so many things that we don't have, that we don't see in novels, so that gay people and people of color don't yet have the books that give full, explosive vitality to their dreams and desires. And I think your book tries to do that.
Yeah. But I also, I knew I wanted it to be a fantasy novel, or at least a speculative, they want to call it that. But I knew I wanted to write a novel where if I was a person from that world, I would never think it was fantasy. It's like I always said to some, like, look at a novel like 100 Years of Solitude. If you give that novel to somebody who grew up Yoruba, they're going to ask, where's the magic? Uh-huh. They're like, what are you talking about? This is reality.
Well, you know, we share. I read a list of your favorite books, and among them is The Master and Margarita, which is one of my, probably one of my top five novels.
Usually one of my top five.
The Song of Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak of where that novel gets in the last 60 pages, mm-hmm. how it manages to jettison anything you might have mm-hmm. expected and go into the luminous, the numinous.
Yeah, it's the riskiest series of pages I've ever read.
Yes.
I still can't get over it. I remember reading it thinking, this book is going to, it has to fly off the rails. It must. And I kept flipping a page going, okay, it's going to fly off the rails now. It's going to fly off the rails now. And I give a story about, I got to the end, when I got to the end of Song of Solomon, I was reading on the balcony. And I was the last place you want to end Song of Solomon. because I believed that ending so completely, I nearly jumped off.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Marlon James about his new novel, Black Leopard, Red Wolf. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Marlon James about Black Leopard, Red Wolf, the stunning first novel in his Black Star trilogy, where myth, fantasy, and history come together into a breathtaking saga. You had on your list mm-hmm. something about African folktale by Belcher.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that book.
I think his name is Stephen Belcher. He's been compiling a lot of the African epics and translating quite a few of them, and he's done a lot of work in that field. And I read pretty much everything he translated, and a lot of the legends and the creatures and the monsters and the gods and so on came from those. Some of the epics are historical. Some are all sort of fantasy and magic. There is one about a cannibal witch and who's outsmarted only by her own daughter. It's a great story. She basically dies of old age because, you know, it's a Western thing to think she'd get her comeuppance. Like, no, she just dies of old age. Growing up in the States, growing up in a sort of diaspora, there's some stories of her, but most I wouldn't have. And I don't think people realize how much your mythology is playing to your society and your psyche. You only notice it when you don't have it. And there's a lot to Roman mythology and Greek mythology that still goes towards shaping who we are, certainly people of European descent. I think in the absence of that, a lot of people like me would think that ground zero for Black people was slavery. And there is a history going thousands and thousands of years before that. And I think being informed by that would have resulted in, I think I'd have been a different person. And so I knew when I was going to write this book, I was going to go, I mean, the earliest piece of evidence that figures in the book is 5,000 years ago. And I would have gone back and I knew it would be sort of almost overwhelming.
I think it is, actually. Mm-hmm. It's one of the pleasures of the book is being overwhelmed mm-hmm. as a reader. And I did have to wonder when the last time with a modern novel I felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tell me, you were born in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
When were you born?
1970.
And were there Jamaican traditions that fed your imagination?
Mm-hmm. Quite a few of the traditions remain. We have like Kumina, and Kumina is a sort of a ceremony. You have Pokomania, which is also another ceremony that kind of invoking spirits. Yeah, at some point, somebody shows up with a machete and chops off a goat's head. Then we eat the goat. So Durazobia, which is like a loose definition would be black magic. There's Mael, which would be the magic to counter it. And even some of the folklore, you know, the Caribbean werewolf, which is Sukuya, you know, with characters like Rolling Calf. A lot of these were, as they came over into the call it the New World, they picked up traits from here. So a lot of these Caribbean folklore, they have some African roots, but they're really Caribbean. But I, you know, my grandfather used to tell me stories, used to tell me Anansi stories. And sometimes it would be the same story every day with one major tweak to it. So, you know, the whole idea of the same story and repetition and so on, just kind of...
Hearing it every day, hearing it again and again, and asking for it. Tell me the story. Because my grandma lived with us. She was from Russia, and she told me Baba Yaga's stories. Baba Yaga was the Russian grandmother witch, and if she retreated from you as she went into the distance, she became larger, so she never disappeared in the distance. She became a huge Baba Yaga. And I loved watching my grandmother make her hugeness with her hands. And, you know, storytelling is generational.
It is generational, and it's oral. And for me, when writing this book, I really wanted it to sound right. I wanted volume. And I wanted it to read as if it's supposed to be read aloud.
It is, and it's beautiful when read aloud. I have to explain, I wanted to read sections of the book, but the language is so profane that it would not be allowed on NPR. And the curses in this book are magical curses.
it's that Calvinism and that sort of Christianity peeking in. Again, the whole idea, for example, of a curse word is like something extra. That it's something forbidden, it's something extra, it's a sign of ignorance. I'm like, no, I always say curse words are a language space. it says if you ever like if you've ever read or heard something like As You Like It in the accent of the British accent of the time, and just how much of it is swearing. And if it's not swearing, it's words that rhymes with swear words. One of the things I love about Shakespeare, and I'm a big devotee of Shakespeare, is just how vulgar he is.
Always.
Yeah, it's this is why I've never understood that whole people thinking that other people wrote Shakespeare. I'm like, nah, this is not a super educated guy to read the plays. These are bawdy and lusty and vulgar.
I think that there's a struggle in this book to shoulder away all of the classic parts of the classic and make them what they truly were, the literature of civilization, of peoples, and of animals. And I wondered, as you were writing, did you giggle knowing what you were doing?
Oh, I was laughing all the time, I think. And yeah, sometimes just poking fun at the ridiculousness of a lot of Western traditions and so on. But also because I knew the characters particularly Tracker was going to be funny.
The Tracker is mostly the narrator of the book. He has a nose. Tell me what a nose is.
He just has a talent for smelling, for tracking whoever, regardless of how far they've gone, whether land or sea or so on. As long as you're alive, he will always smell you. And it used to be something that drove him mad until he figured out how to use it.
And you see, a lot of the rankness of smells in this book is part of the pleasure, because when they investigate each other's bodies, they go from the top of the head to the toes, and there's a lot of time spent between the buttocks.
It's funky. I also, you know, I knew I wanted a book that smelled. I wanted a book that smelled. I wanted a book that had, as not just volume, but I wanted a book with a funk. I wanted a book that smelled.
Yes. This man, the tracker, is gradually, more gradually than the black leopard, who can be human as well as leopard, our narrator, the tracker, becomes Red Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes time for him to be given his color.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered about color in this book.
Mm-hmm. Color is interesting, again, because I'm coming from a, you know, a world where we just look at black and white, and both are one color. And to explore color within blackness or brownness or so on was really, really fascinating. You know, some of the characters I mentioned in the book are so black they're blue, and others are the color of sand. And that there is still this sort of huge range of diversity in a set of peoples that people think didn't have any. And I definitely wanted to touch on that.
I want to tell all my listeners that Black Leopard Red Wolf is a mammoth, joyous, festive surprise. But this is a great book. We will potentially be living with Black Leopard, Red Wolf for our children's children to read. And this was very exciting to me to think that my children's children, I have no children, that our children's children.
Mm-hmm.
will have a book where everything is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Every sex, every religion, every color, every god, every animal. It's a violent sexual world, and everyone belongs in it. Mm-hmm. There are no exclusions.
Yeah.
I've been talking with Marlon James, author of Black Leopard, Red Wolf. It's the first volume of his Dark Star trilogy. It's published by Riverhead Books. It's going to, people are going to be talking about it for a long, long time. If mine is complete excitement, you might talk to someone else whose reaction was disgust. The excitement of a book that inspires varying response mm-hmm. is an important excitement. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Plus, you can listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my co-producer and assistant, Sean Sullivan, whose birthday it is as we tape this show. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Join me again next time on Bookworm when Yi-Yun Lee is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.